Boker Tov, Erev Tov, everybody, and part seven, a part I removed to David HaMelech, I believe, this morning. So, Bakasha, Rachel.
Thank you. Today's the penultimate episode, if this was a TV series, right? Next week, we're going to wrap it all up. I can't believe it's been so fast. It's been so brisk running through all these books and all these storylines. But today we're hitting, as is appropriate for the penultimate episode of a TV series, a major event. And the major, major event is King David stepping onto history's stage. And this is the event that's really going to crystallize all the processes we followed from the very beginning of the book of Judges, through all the turmoil of that era and their civil war, through Prophet Shmuel's career, through King Shaul's failures. All those processes are going to coalesce in David and leave us with the legacy of a united Israelite kingdom, which, as we knew, lasted for two generations, but this is more than it ever lasted until that point. And of course, the name of David lasted long, long, the name, the legacy, the model of David lasted long after even the destruction of his house and the temple when Jerusalem fell. So, major events, let's delve into it. And I want to make a methodological comment first, that it's hard because we have to do two things at once in this class. We have to cover the basic contours of the David story and make sure that we're all on the same page and we all know what happened at point A, point B, point C, point D. But we also want to be able to delve into specific points and get something out of them and really understand not merely the superficial plot line that the story is showing us, but what are the deeper underlying processes that the storyteller is trying to draw our attention in or guide us into noticing. So to make it a little bit easier, I'm actually going to start by doing a little bit of an introduction and just a very, very brief retelling of the David story until his ascension. And then we're going to go back and start digging together. So King David steps onto the stage after God tells Shmuel to dismiss Shaul, to tell Shaul that he failed and he can no longer be the king. And he sends Shmuel, and we will delay on that in a minute, to find the young man that he wants to become the king and anoint him in secret. And this puts us into this complicated era where we have the visible official king, the man with the power, Shaul, and the invisible, hidden, unacknowledged king that's yet anointed by God, King David. To make the situation all the more ironic, David finds his way to King Shaul's court, where he becomes popular, successful, beloved, where he marries the king's daughter and becomes best friends with the king's son and heir, Yonatan. And the more popular David becomes, the more jealous, resentful, angry, suspicious, tortured King Shaul becomes. He starts acting in ways that are violent towards David. He throws a spear on him in two different occasions. He tries to plot against him somewhat ineffectively. It gets to the point that David can no longer stay in court and has to run away, aided and abetted both by his wife, the king's daughter, Michal, and his best friend, the king's son, Yonatan, who work against their own father to help David escape. Then starts the era when David is outcast and a mercenary, almost, traveling around, collecting all kinds of bitter, disenchanted people to his banner. All kinds of people who are described as kashim, as difficult people, people who have grievances. These people gather around David and they travel together. Shaul every now and then goes and gives chase trying to capture David and kill him, but David constantly outpaces and outwits him.
Oh, Shaul is his father-in-law.
Yeah.
Sorry? Did somebody just speak up? Oh, okay, just reminder to mute yourself. Thank you. And then this continues for a while. Eventually, it gets to the point that David sees he can no longer dwell in King Shaul's jurisdiction because King Shaul continuously gives chase, apologizes, acknowledges that he's in the wrong, and then again is becoming overwhelmed with his emotions of resentfulness and hatred, and gives chase, and once again apologizes and says, oh, I'm in the wrong, you are better than me, David, I know you're better than me. We see the child too is ambivalent and conflicted within himself and his responses to David. At some point, King David says, okay, this is enough, and he goes and becomes a mercenary of the Philistines, enemies of the Israelites. At this point of the story, the two strands, King Shaul's strand and King David's strands, come together when the Philistines muster for the great battle that will cost Shaul his life. And in a last-minute twist, even though they were going to use David in battle, they decide that maybe they don't want to trust this man from Israel to fight against his brethren and send him away. In this great climactic battle, King Shaul and his sons die. King David obviously survives since he is not there, and he becomes king of Judah. The rest of the tribes of Israel remain under the leadership of King Shaul's youngest son, and the men behind the throne, King Shaul's, general, right-hand man, Avner Ben-Ner. We will get to that later, to that last moment when there's two kings at once, both of them visible, not like in the beginning where King Shaul is socially accepted and visible and King David is just anointed by God, but otherwise not in a position of leadership. We will get to a point where there's two kings in parallel, David and Shaul's son, but we will get to that later. Now that we did a little bit of a review and we're all can recognize different points in this plot, let's delve in. And I want to start today's exploration with a mystery. Mysteries are good, right? Mysteries, when there's a mystery in a story, it gets us going, it gets us guessing, it gets us engaged. And there's a mystery in the David story right off the bat. And the mystery is that King David is introduced to us, the readers, not one time, not two times, three times. Let's look at it together in the source sheet. I am in box number one, and here. The very first time he is introduced is when God sends the prophet Shmuel to anoint him. And the Lord said to Shmuel, how long will you grieve after Shaul, since I have rejected him as king of Israel? Fill your horn with oil and set out. I am sending you to Ishai the Bethlehemite, Ishai mi Bethlehemi, for I have decided on one of the sons to be king. Then there follows a whole long scene that we're going to read more in detail in a moment. As we said, Shmuel anoints David in secret and walks away. But then David is introduced into the story again. And this time it happens by following his introduction to King Shaul. Let's look together here later in the same chapter, chapter 16. Now the spirit of the Lord had departed from Shaul, and an evil spirit from the Lord began to terrify him. Shaul's courtier said to him, an evil spirit of God is terrifying you. Let our Lord give the order, and the courtiers in attendance on you will look for someone who is skilled at playing the lyre. Whenever this evil spirit of God comes over you, he will play it and you will feel better. So Shaul said to his courtiers, find me someone who can play well and bring him to me. And the courtiers go on and hear about this lovely boy from Bethlehem, son of Ishai, who plays beautifully. They bring him to King Shaul. King Shaul comes to love him and adopts him into the court. Okay, so we were introduced to him. Shaul was introduced to him. Enough, right? No. The text goes and introduces Shaul and us to David again, as if the two haven't met before. And they do that in a very different setting. If the first introduction between Shaul and David happens in the setting of Shaul's court, in a moment of leisure, with activities of leisure, such as music, the third moment where we meet David and the second moment when Shaul meets David is on the battlefield. Here's how the story goes. I'm at the same box on the bottom. A champion of the Philistine forces stepped forward. I'll just introduce the situation. There's a standstill. The Philistine camp and Shaul's camp are encamped one across the other. The Philistines were people who lived on the seaboard, constantly want to go up into the hill land, the Shephelah, and eventually into the mountains, which is where the strongholds are of the Israelite kingdom. And King Shaul constantly tries to push them down from the hill, way into their big cities by the ocean. So there's two camps in the Shephelah, in a place called Emek Elah, Valley of Elah, and they're in a standstill. Nobody wants to start the battle and give up the advantage of whatever hill they're encamped on. And then comes this man, the champion of the Philistines, stepping forward. His name was Goliath of Gath, and he was 6 cubits and a span tall. And the story goes on and on and on to tell us all about his equipment and how heavy it was and how expensive it was. And this man stands up and says, "You, who are you? You are weak people." And he says, I'm jumping ahead to the middle of verse 10, "I herewith defy the ranks of Israel. Get me a man and let's fight it out." Basically saying, instead of our armies fighting against each other, let us fight one-on-one. When Shaul and all of Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and terror-stricken. The Philistine stepped forward morning and evening and took his stand for 40 days. For 40 days, twice a day, he comes out and makes his challenge, and nobody dares to stand against him. When the men of Israel saw the men, they fled in terror. And into this scene steps the little shepherd David, who is sent. He's not a soldier in the army. He is sent from his father to bring things to his brothers, who are soldiers in the Israelite camp. And when he gets there, and again, we will read the details in a moment, he volunteers to become the champion who will fight Goliath. And as they say, the rest is history. Bizarrely, instead of saying, "Oh, my musician, thank you for coming and saving the day," Shaul says, "Who is this boy? Who is his father?" As if he knows nothing about him. So before we go into each of these stories, each of these introductions, and really unpack it, I want to address the basic mystery of what's going on here. Why are there 3 introductions? You could say that 2 introductions are okay, because one time he's anointed in secret and another time he's introduced into the court. Fine, that's important for the events that will follow, for David to rise in favor in the court and accrue Shaul's resentment, etc., etc. But why 3 introductions? Especially, in particularly, why do we need to see 2 introductions to King Shaul in which he doesn't seem to recognize him? It's almost, in fact, and this was the answer that many academic scholars in the 19th century, non-Jewish academic scholars, gave to this question. It's almost as if we have 2 separate sources. There's 2 traditions about how David became part of Shaul's retinue. One has to do with David the musician. Another has to do with David the great warrior. Also, they said, maybe it's not even the same David. Maybe it's 2 different mythical characters being combined. In short, they said there's 2 stories, and the editor of the book of Shmuel just took these 2 sources, put them together without too much refinement, and left it as it is. As you can probably guess, I do not particularly like this answer. Not because I find it particularly sacrilegious. I don't think it's necessarily sacrilegious to say that the biblical storyteller in this particular book does all kinds of artful things with stories. I mean, otherwise I wouldn't be teaching a course about storytelling in the book, right? But because I think that it's a lazy answer. It's an answer that says we have 2 things that don't go together very well. Let's just say that the editor did a bad job. Done. We don't need to explain it. This is not good enough. Why did the editor not do a better job? Why, even if you believe that there's 2 separate sources here, why would the person combining them not work a little bit harder to smooth them together? And why assume that there's 2 sources instead of assuming that the text is trying to teach us something? And I want to offer a different insight into the 3 introductions. I want to suggest, and the text, I think, corroborates it, that the 3 introductions are there to draw our attention to a particular point. there's storytellers often talk about the rule of three. You know it, right? Without even knowing it, you know it. You hear a fairy tale. There's always three attempts and only the third succeeds. Three suitors want the hand of the princess. The third succeeds. Three something. It's as if when we see something that comes in a pattern of three, it emphasizes something for us. It comes together for us as important. And here, by introducing David three times, the storyteller both emphasizes something that's common across all those three introductions and has more, how would I put it, more opportunities to draw our attention to key facets of David's personality, of David's style of being that will become important later on. The one thing that the three events have in common is that in all of them, David's place in the story is shaped by a failure that can be attributed to King Shaul. In the first source, it's explicit. God tells Shmuel, go and anoint this boy because King Shaul disappointed me and I reject him. I no longer want to have him as a king. And this leads back to all the failures we discussed last time, his failures to kill the Amalekite king, his wishy-washy attitude when people put pressure on him, etc. So this is directly, the first introduction is directly tying David's rise with Shaul's failure as a king. The second introduction ties David's appearance to the evil spirit that makes Shaul behave in erratic ways. As we will see later in the story, and you can read it for yourself later, this evil spirit keeps moving Shaul to behavior that's less and less stable, more and more moody, more and more resentful, more and more unlike the man he was in the beginning of his days. And it's through that failing, which is a very severe failing for a king, and we can set aside the question of, is it his fault or God's fault for a moment? We can come back to it later if you want. Through this failing to be stable, to have a clear head, to set a course and then follow it instead of being moved by these evil moods to act against whatever you already said you're going to do, etc. That gives us King David. Once again, sorry. David's appearance is framed in terms of Shaul's failure. The third one is a little more subtle. In the third one, we don't watch Shaul fail in the sense that he does something wrong, but rather we watch Shaul not doing something right. Here stands this Philistine man for 40 days. 40 days is more than a month. People, excuse me, watch the moon wax and wane at least once while waiting, encamped there in the hills in difficult conditions and under constant threat, constantly afraid that the battle is going to break and it's not going to be in their favor, having to have people supply them with food, like young King David bringing food to his brothers in the field. And for 40 days, this Philistine guy comes out and curses God, and King Shaul does not respond. King Shaul is too scared to act against him. It is pretty obvious when someone comes and says, I am the champion of the Philistine. Let the Israelites send their champion. It's pretty obvious that the leader is the one expected to say, I will champion the Israelites, or at least to encourage one of the men around him to send someone to the field. And yet we see Shaul once more beset by indecision. Just as he didn't kill the king of Amalek before, just as he was hesitant and didn't know what to do in other cases, here he is again, leading the people and yet not stepping up in the crucial moment. And King David comes and steps into this lacuna of leadership, the lacuna of a role model who can stand up and say, I will win in the name of God. And I am not scared of the Philistine, despite his many, many weapons and impressive breastplate and whatnot. David only has room to step in and make such statements because Shaul did not. by having all of these stories one by one, the storyteller makes sure that we notice this pattern, that we see that King David is necessitated by Shaul's instances of falling short. But each of them also gives us an insight or a key, if you wish, to one particular and particularly important element of the Davidic, I don't even know how to say it. It's not just character. It's his all aura, the way he does things, the way he is described, his effect on other people. And I want to pause now on each of these stories and note those keys. Let's start with the first one. The moment when Shmuel comes to anoint David in secret in his father's house. When they arrive, when they is Shmuel and Ishai, whom he met and informed that he needs to choose a new king from amongst his sons, when they arrived and he saw Eliab was the oldest son, Ishai's oldest son, he, and we're talking about Shmuel here, thought, surely the Lord's anointed stands before him. But the Lord said to Shmuel, pay no attention to his appearance or his stature, for I have rejected him. For not as men sees does the Lord see. Men sees only what is visible, but the Lord sees into the heart. So we're already given a hint here that there's hidden depth in David. But whoever the actual chosen person is, and note that at this point we haven't met him yet, he's not there yet in the picture, there's something about him that's deceitful or deceptive, if you wish to say it this way. There's something about him that doesn't, things are not as they appear. Okay, Ishai is going to call his other sons. Then Ishai called Avinadab and had him pass before Shmuel. But he said, the Lord has not chosen this one either. Next, Jesse presented Shema. And again, he said, the Lord has not chosen this one either. Thus, Ishai presented seven of his sons before Shmuel, and Shmuel said to Jeshai, the Lord has not chosen any of these. Let's pause here for a second and note something interesting. Seven sons go before Shmuel, and Shmuel says, not this, not this, not this, not this. Now, we know that there's another youngest son, right? King David, because we know that he's about to become the king. So we know that this household is supposed to include the man who will be the king. It's not a mystery to us, the reader. We know that. So what do we expect at this point? We expect Ishai to say, oh, here's another son, and that will be the chosen one. But this is not what happens. Instead, Shmuel has to ask him for Ishai to even tell him that another son exists. Then Shmuel asked Ishai, are these all the boys you have? He replied, there is still the youngest. He is tending the flock. Note that not only did Ishai not mention the existence of the son before Shmuel asked for him, not only did he not send to bring him in when Shmuel said, I want to see all of your sons, he doesn't even mention him by name. And Shmuel said to Ishai, send someone to bring him, for we will not sit down to eat until he gets here. And only then do we meet King David. So they sent and brought him. He was ruddy-cheeked, bright-eyed, and handsome. And the Lord said, rise and anoint him, for this is the one. Shmuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the presence of his brothers. And the spirit of the Lord gripped David, suddenly as a name. Only when God elects him does he have a name. Until this moment, no one in the household mentions him by name. From that day on, Shmuel then set out for Ramah. The first thing that we know about King David, and we know that before he becomes king, is that in some way, he is absent from his father's mind. He is absent from the house. He is absent from his father's notice. He is absent, it seems, from his father's favor, because his father not only doesn't include him, he neglects to even mention him, or later when he's forced to mention him by name. In other words, instead of meeting David head on, the first thing we learn about David is that in some ways, he isn't there. This is a striking contrast to how King Shao was introduced. Do you remember that King Shao was introduced through his relationship, his good relationship with his father? We were told that there was this man of Binyamin who was good, etc., and he had a son, Shaul. And the first thing we see about Shaul is that his father sends him on a quest. And Shaul is clearly preoccupied with his father's well-being and wants to serve him well and doesn't want to worry him. In an almost mirror image, the first thing we learn about David is that he is not of value to his father. He is not appreciated or on his father's mind in the same way that there's the other sons are. Eli Paso is writing in the chat correctly that there's a midrash, a famous midrash, that says that there was some question surrounding David's legitimacy, that he was a legitimate son, but Ishai, for a reason we're not going to go into now, questioned it. What the midrash is catching on to, we're not going to talk about it now because we're trying to talk only on the simple chat level, on the actual story as it is in the text. But what this midrash catches on to very well is the feeling that there's something wrong, there's something rotten between Ishai and David. Why is this such an important point? First of all, it's a contrast to Shaul. And as we saw with Shaul, there was a certain feeling that Shaul kept trying to find a source of authority. He kept trying to lean on father-like figures, be it his father or Shmuel, to guide him, and didn't have the steel, didn't have the spine to stand on his own two feet. So we're already given a hint that King David is going to be of a totally different caliber, that he's going to be, because he grew up somewhat neglected, he must have learned to stand on his own two feet. Think about all the orphan children in stories from Harry Potter and Cinderella to can't think of other, Aladdin. You can think of many examples. Something about the lack of parental figures in the hero's life means that the hero has to learn to take initiative and be independent from a young age. So with King David, we're given already this hint that this is what we're going to see. There's another hint here, and Rabbi David Wolpe, in his wonderful book that I highly, highly recommend, called David, the Divided Heart, makes a beautiful point that David, the first half of David's life that we're going to explore today, is in a sense marked by his problematic relationship with Shaul, who was kind of a father figure for him, a father-in-law, literally. The second half of David's life is marked by his problematic relationship with his own children. And in a sense, this moment that we see at the very introduction of David, the tension between him and his father, is a foreshadowing of these events or these tensions that will shape all of David's life. But what I want to suggest is that there's another key storytelling hint happening here. Not only are we seeing something about David's independence, not only are we learning that father's and son's relationship are going to be important in the story, we're seeing another thing. We're seeing that other people have opinions about David. His father disdains him. Shmuel is looking for him. God wants him. But at the same time, David himself, his interior, his internal world is somehow absent. In this scene, he is physically absent and also mentally absent from his father's notice. But what we will see throughout David's life is that David, despite the fact that he is taking initiative, taking action, doing, acting, changing reality in so many ways all around him, his internal life is oddly hidden. In many, many key moments in his life, we see what he does, but we don't know why. He's not forthcoming with explanations. King Shaul was fairly transparent. We're told time and time again, the text tells us, King Shaul thought this. King Shaul felt that. With David, it's much more rare. We see what he says and we see what he does, but the secrets that lie at his heart, his deep motivations, are hidden. And this will become a key element of what made David succeed and what challenged him, and we will get to that later on. The second introduction, the one that places him in the court as a musician, introduces another key aspect of David's character. What it introduces to us is his attractiveness. Because in that scene, which I can't give you, we're not going to look at it right now. You're welcome to look at it later in the text. We immediately see how Shaul, the king, comes to love this young musician. And this begins a pattern that will repeat itself time and time and time again in David's life. David is the most beloved man in the entire Bible. And I'm saying that not just in a, you know, fanciful way. If you count how many times we're here that people love David, it exceeds any other character as an object of affection in the Bible. He is the only man in the Bible that we hear in words that his wife comes to love him. His wife, Michal, loves him. No other woman in the Bible is described with this word, ohevet, as loving her husband. He is beloved by the king, Shaul. Even when Shaul chases him down, he still loves him and in his more lucid moments regrets it. He is beloved by the man who should be king after Shaul, by the way of the world, which is Yonatan. He is beloved by the people who every time he leads them into battle come to love him more and more and more. Something about him he has a certain attractiveness, a certain charisma that draws everybody to him. And this will be a big part, a big secret to King David's success in rising to power and uniting the people around him. The third introduction, the moment when David steps onto the battlefield and volunteers to fight a giant, a very well garbed and very well equipped giant, introduces us to another interesting and troubling, one might say, aspect of David. And it's related to something we already mentioned, namely his mystique, the fact that we don't always know what's going on within him. What we see from David's behavior in the Goliath story is that he combines very noble motivations, very noble goals, very noble actions, with a lot of self-serving motivation. There's a certain ambiguity, a certain duality in King David, who is constantly both speaking and acting in ways that mark him as a great man, as someone who places other people's well-being before himself, as someone who is very much a servant of God. And yet, he seems to also be extremely pragmatic, always thinking how things can play in his favor. Again, I'm following here Rabbi David Wolpe's interpretation in David the Divided Heart, but let's look at it together in the text for a little bit. Moment. The first, when David comes to camp and he hears Goliath stand up once again and cursing God, the people around him are talking. And here's what they say. I'm in the third box. And the men of Israel were saying among themselves, "Do you see that man coming out? He comes out to defy Israel. The man who kills him will be rewarded by the king with great riches. He will also give him his daughter in marriage and grant exemption to his father's house in Israel," exemption from taxes. David asked the men standing near him, "What will be done for the man who kills that Philistine and removes the disgrace from Israel? Who is that uncircumcised Philistine that he dares defy the ranks of the living God?" Before he talks about defying the ranks of the living God, David's first question is very pragmatic. What would I get? What the person who attacks this man, what would he get? Only later, after he says, "I will defeat this person," and the rumor comes out and the king hears that there's this young man who says he can defeat the giant and summons him to him, do we see David the noble, David the selfless, stepping onto the stage? Because when Shaul says, "You said you want to attack him," here's what David says in response. David said to Shaul, "Let no man's courage fail him. Your servant will go and fight that Philistine." But Shaul said to David, "You cannot go to that Philistine and fight him. you are only a boy, and he has been a warrior from his youth. David replied to Shaul, your servant has been tending his father's sheep. And if a lion or a bear came and carried off an animal from the flock, I would go after it and fight it and rescue it from its mouth. And that uncircumcised Philistine shall end up like one of them, for he has defied the ranks of the living God. The Lord, David went on, who saved me from the lion and the bear, will also save me from that Philistine. Then go, said Shaul to David, and may the Lord be with you. This is a moment when we see David, not the pragmatic, what will I get out of it, David, but rather the heroic, believing in God, David. And yet both of them coexist. You can't dismiss the one or the other. You can't dismiss the fact that the first thing we see David say is, what will I get out of it? But you also can't dismiss the fact that he does step out to fight against the giant, clearly motivated or clearly acting in accordance with his words when he says that he believes God will defend him. Interestingly, there's this beautiful ironic moment here that follows. When King Shaul says, fine, you're going, but you need to be dressed in appropriate gear. And Shaul closes David in his own garments. This is a moment of high irony when Shaul gives his own royal garb to the man who is about to replace him as king, the man who later Shaul will be very concerned about replacing him as king. But Shaul is the first to give him royal garb, except that at this point, David doesn't want him. David wears the breastplate, wears the helmet, gears his sword over his garment, tries to walk, and he sees that he can't move in these clothes. He's not used to them. This is not what he's used to. And so he says to Shaul, I cannot walk in these for I am not used to them. So David took them off. David's kingship, the moment where he will don the garbs of kingship, is not yet here. Yet the foreshadowing of that moment is already happening. Instead, as the story goes, he took his stick, picked a few smooth stones from the wadi, put them in the pocket of his shepherd's bag, and sling in hand, he went toward the Philistine. And here we're introduced to yet another particularly Davidic trait. Let's just sum up where we are. We saw that the introductions, just by the fact that they repeat themselves and have shared characteristics, emphasize the fact that David rises as an answer to Shaul's failures, or he completes or he excels in those places where Shaul fails. We saw that he's absent from his father's mind. We saw that implies a certain mystery about what motivates him, that he's also absent from the story as he's hidden in the story. He's not revealed fully to our eye. We saw that he's very beloved, attractive, and charismatic. And we saw that there's a certain ambiguity about him that goes along hand in hand with this mystery about what motivates him, that he really seems to be a jumble of self-interest and selflessness and heroics and pragmatism. Another thing that we see in the Goliath story in particular is that he's exceedingly lucky. And of course, the word lucky is absolutely wrong, because David doesn't succeed by chance. David makes his luck. David looks at this giant and he sees why everybody is scared. He sees that this is an enormously capable man with enormous sword, an enormous bracelet, an enormous helmet. How is anybody supposed to win against him? How is that supposed to work? If David were to accept the terms of engagements that Goliath clearly expects him to accept, i.e. fight hand to hand or sword to sword, obviously he will lose. Just as Shaul would lose, Yonatan would lose, anybody would lose, and that's why they're not fighting. But where other people look at it and don't see a way out and feel that there's nothing they can do and stall and wait there for 40 days and 40 nights, kind of like Moses in the mountain, by the way, David shows up and says, why should I fight on these terms? And instead he takes a rock and throws it on Goliath and hits him and kills him like that. And this is a trait we will see in King David time and time again. People have certain expectations. There's a certain conventional way of what to do. there are certain expected choices. David goes and does something else. If you remember, when we talked about Ruth, we already noted the same trait in her. When we talked about Megillat Ruth, we saw that Ruth doesn't do the conventional thing. She doesn't go back to her parents' house to live with them and build a new family. She insists on following her mother-in-law, despite knowing that there's no chances, there's no future for her, and going to live in a foreign country. In a similar way, her great-great-great-grandson, David, faced with all kinds of dire straits, finds another way out. Later on, when he will become king of all of Israel, there's going to be an open question, where will his capital be? Since he started his life, or started his kingly career, as the king of Judah, which is still far away from us in the story, but we mentioned in the beginning that he becomes crowned in Judah, by the tribe of Judah. Maybe some people expect him to choose a capital in the lands of the tribe of Judah. On the other hand, now he's inviting all of the Israelites to become part of his kingdom. This will happen after 2 years in which he is a king in Judah and the son of Shaul is a king in Israel. But then two people who want to curry David's favor go and murder Shaul's son. David, of course, does not approve. He executes them. And yet he reaps the benefits in the sense that then the other tribes say, okay, fine, we want to be under David as well. And David becomes the king of all of Israel. So there's a question, will he build his capital in the Judah areas, thus signifying that he's still more a king of his own tribe than other tribes? Or will he choose a capital in the other tribes, like in Benjamin, where King Shaul was from, thus perhaps sending a somewhat alienating message to his own tribe, who was the first to follow him, that now they're no longer as important to him? A difficult choice to make for any king, for any leader. What does David do? He goes and conquers a Jebusite city and builds a new capital there. He just doesn't play by the rules. He doesn't accept the kind of choices that other men might deliberate between and then choose one. He just says, no, I'm making my way. He does it his way. And we see that already in the Goliath case. And the amazing thing is that David succeeds. Time and time again, he makes these unconventional choices and he succeeds. David Wolpe calls it almost a rule of physics. That David changes physics, because the text describes that he threw a rock. The rock hits Goliath. Where would we expect Goliath to fall to? Backwards, right? But we're told that Goliath fell forward. And David Wolpe writes that, in a sense, it's almost an embodiment or a metaphor for the entire David style. He does things that go against convention and they work. Time and time again, he does things that defy expectation and he wins. I want to show you how Rabbi Wolpe puts it, since it's beautiful. I'm in box 5. Perhaps he stumbled and fell forward, but it may also be the Tanakh's way of reminding us that David's action evoke contraries. He succeeds in weird ways. Shaul, whom he will usurp, loves him. He will fraternize with the enemy, that is, when he goes and becomes a mercenary in the Philistine court. And neither they nor Israel seem to turn on him as a result. That the tribes later accept David back without any backlash for this time that he spent as a Philistine mercenary. His adulterous affair, we'll discuss that next week, will produce a son who grows to be a successor. David does not operate by the normal physics of human consequences. His stone hits and the stricken fall forward. From these introductions, we watch how David rises in power. First, he is adopted into the court. We see it happening twice, first as a musician and then as a commander. After the Goliath, he's taken in by, first of all, Shaul loves him, Jonathan loves him, and they take him in as a commander of the army. And his attractiveness and his luck, for lack of a better word, come into display very quickly, and he becomes extremely successful in battle. And from battle to battle, his popularity rises to the point that everybody loves him. Everybody goes and sings for him wherever he appears. The daughter of the king falls in love with him. And Shaul starts to feel afraid. the more David rises, the more afraid of him Shaul becomes. Even, and the irony is that every time Shaul is scared, every time Shaul is afraid, he tries to take action, and this action backfires. We will look at one example of this because it's an important example, and then we will jump ahead and see how it all comes to a close together to the moment of David's ascension. The example I want to look at with you is David's marriage, how David's marriage comes to be. David's marriage to the princess. This is a perfect example of several of the lines we talked about before. It's a perfect example of how, of the irony of Shaul trying to do something against David, but instead giving him more power and more popularity. It's a perfect example of David's mystery, because as we will see when we read it now, everybody else in the scene is transparent. Everybody else, we're told what they think and what they feel, except David himself. And it's also a great example of his belovedness, how attractive he is to other people. I am going to go up to box number 4. We're not going to read all of it together, but we'll skim through it a little bit. After David succeeds in battle, Shaul says, "Here is my elder daughter, Merav. I will give her to you in marriage. In return, you be my warrior and fight the battles of the Lord." Shaul thought, "Let not my hand strike him. Let the hand of the Philistines strike him." The entire sequence of events starts with ill intention on Shaul's mind. He wants David to fail. He wants to put David in the forefront of battle in the hope that he will die. Also, Shaul is extremely transparent. We know what he says and we know what he thinks and we know that it's not the same. David replied to Shaul, "Who am I and what is my life, my father's family in Israel, that I should become your majesty's son-in-law?" But we don't know if he means that. We don't know if he really feels unworthy or he just says it because this is the conventional rote things to say. We don't know. It's just not given to us. And then something weird happens. Merav becomes married to somebody else. There's some ambivalence going on there. But now a new daughter steps onto the stage. Now Michal, daughter of Shaul, had fallen in love with David. And when this was reported to Shaul, he was pleased. Shaul thought, again, Shaul is transparent. We know what he's thinking. "I will give her to him and she can serve as a snare for him so that the Philistines may kill him." So Shaul said to David, "You can become my son-in-law even now through the second one." And Shaul instructed his courtiers to say to David privately, "The king is fond of you and all his courtiers like you, so why not become the king's son-in-law?" And at first, David is reluctant again. He keeps saying, we don't know what he's thinking, but he says no. And then Shaul sends a courtier out again. "Say this to David, the king desires no other bright price than the foreskins of 100 Philistines as vengeance on the king's enemies." Shaul intended, again, transparency, to bring about David's death at the end of the Philistines. But David is pleased, and this is the first time we hear something about his internal state. He's pleased. In Hebrew, we say, "Vayishar hadavar b'enei Shaul." It was good, it was straight, it was the right thing to do in the eyes of David to marry the king's daughter. But we don't know why he's pleased. We hear about his emotional response, but it's almost like a tease because we understand he's pleased, but is he pleased about the political aspect of it? Is he pleased about the personal aspect of it? Not so clear. And then, of course, he goes out and kills 200 Philistines and brings their foreskins, and Shaul has to give him his daughter. And it is at that moment that Shaul feels the irony hit him. And when Shaul realized that the Lord was with David and that Michal's daughter of Shaul loved him, Shaul grew still more afraid of David. And Shaul was David's enemy ever after. But while Shaul becomes an enemy, David's popularity only continues to grow. The Philistine chiefs marched out to battle, and every time they marched out, David was more successful than all the other officers of Shaul. His reputation soared. Where does this all lead us? Okay, so we learned all these different things about David. Great, but why is it important? Why do we need to know that he's so popular? Why do we need to know that Shaul pushes him into kingship first by falling short, and later by actively pursuing him in ways that actually enhance David's popularity, that somehow play in David's favor? And most importantly, why is it so important for us to know that we don't know him, that King David on some level is a mystery to us? One possible answer, and I think that it's an answer worth pausing and deliberating on, is that the big problem, one of the two big problems we saw with King Shaul, was that he was influenced by other people. When the people didn't want to kill all the lambs, they didn't kill all the lambs. When Shmuel told him something, he did it. But then when Shmuel wasn't there, he did what other people who were around him told him. He kept wanting to go back to his father. He, at the eve of his death, is looking for counsel desperately, to the point that he goes and raises the dead against his own principle, against his life project of eradicating such practices from Israel in accordance to God's law. Time and time again, he is, in Hebrew you would say, lachitz, pressurable. People can put pressure on him and he becomes, he goes with wherever they pressure him to go. And we pondered last week that perhaps the first hint to that, the first key we're given to that, is his close relationship with his father. Already there, we see a certain dependence on other people around him. The flip side of this dependence on other people around him is that he is not following God. The one, number one demand that Shmuel wants to be fulfilled for a king to be a successful king, that Shmuel and God look for in a potential king, is that he will be a king under God. Instead of replacing God, becoming a new idol, in a sense, something that will distance the people from God and eventually lead to their demise, because God will abandon them in turn, he needs to be someone who can connect them to him. Shaul can't do it because he's too influenced by the different people around him and he's not enough influence or not enough in a relationship with God himself. What we see when we look at David is that in his interactions with other people, he is mysterious. He is withheld. He is in some deep level his own person, to the point that even we, the listeners or audience of his exploits thousands of years later, don't know what he thinks. We don't know what he thinks while this whole drama of marriage to Michal happens around him. We're not sure what motivates him to go and fight the giant. Is it self-interest or is it idealism in the name of God? We're not sure what he thinks when Shmuel taps him and says, "You're it." We're not sure. We know what everybody else thinks, but we don't know what he thinks. But you know, when he does express himself, when we do see his internal world, we see it in the Psalms. We see it whenever David finds himself in conversation, not with other people, but with God himself. Because the one relationship where David brings himself fully to the table, puts it all there, the bad and the good, the hopes and the fears, the experiences and the internal musings, is when he is in conversation with God. Next week, we're going to see the problems in David's relationships. We're going to see how time after time after time, his personal relationships with the people closest to him collapse, fall short, become complicated. Time and time again, David, just like his father withheld his favor and notice, David withholds his favor and notice from the people around him. But through it all, one relationship keeps motivating him, keeps being true to him, keeps keeping him true to his ideals and open and revealed to us. And this is his relationship with God. And perhaps this is why this trait is so important. His mystique on the one hand, his mysteriousness and his openness to God. Because when we're looking for a king who will be a king under God, who better than the man whose one driving passion, one driving relationship is a relationship with God himself. We will touch upon that next week. We're going to talk about it again. Before we wrap up today, I do want to talk briefly about the end point of what we could say the upward trend in David's story, the moment when he becomes, in truth, king of all of Israel. During the years that David is traveling, or more accurately, running away from Shaul, Shaul takes Michal, the daughter who is David's wife, and gives her to another man. When David starts working his way up to power after Shaul's death, one of the first thing he does, and he does it, I'm not going to go into the whole story, but he demands the return of his wife, Michal. And Michal is indeed returned to him. And there's a very touching scene where she is being taken to David, and her husband for those years that David was away walks behind the carriage, walks behind her, halokh v'bakho, going and crying, walking and crying. It's a very powerful image that to build his house, his dynasty, David has to break apart other houses. Specifically here, the house that Michal shared, the home, the family that she shared with Paltiel ben Laish, her other husband. But more generally, the house of Shaul. For the home of David, for the house of David to rise, the house of Shaul has to collapse. And we see that at a pinnacle moment in David's life, when after he became king of all of Israel and united the kingdom, after he conquered Jerusalem, he brings the ark that was lost to us when Eli's house fell. Remember when Eli, who started the story of Shmuel sitting down and then died sitting down after his sons died in battle and the ark was taken by the Philistines, when Eli's house fell, we lost the ark. David, the action he does when he finally unites the house of Israel, builds his house in Jerusalem, is to bring the ark back to be at their center. And he does it with great celebration. He dances before the ark. He blesses the people. He gives people gifts. Everybody, with the slaves and the slave girls and the commoners, everybody is dancing together, celebrating the coming of the ark to Jerusalem. The ancient mistake of using the ark as a talisman is corrected. There's a king. There's a united kingdom. And there's a queen, Queen Michal, a queen amongst queens. David has many wives at this point. And when she sees David dancing, what the Torah, what the text tells us is, "Vatavaz lo beliba," and she scorned him in her heart. And she goes towards him and tells him, "Oh, how honored you are today that you danced before the slave girls of Israel, that you revealed yourself in this way before the slave girls of Israel." And David tells her off in very, very harsh rebuke. And let's just read that and finish on that note. Not that it's a happy note. I'm here at the very end of the source sheet. David answered Michal, "It was before the Lord who chose me instead of your father and all his family and appointed me ruler over the Lord's people Israel." Meaning I didn't dance before the people. I didn't reveal myself or demean myself before the people. I demean myself before God. And not only God, the God who chose me over your house. This is a very harsh moment, a cruel moment almost, where he associates her with her father. And he says, "You are rejected. I, who can dance before God, I am chosen." As we said before, this is actually true. The fact that he can demean himself before God is crucial to why he's chosen and Shaul isn't. And he goes on and says, "I will dance before the Lord and dishonor myself even more and be low in my own esteem. But among the slave girls that you speak of, I will be honored. You, the princess who grew up in Shaul's house under Shaul's mistake, you may scorn me," says David. "You don't understand what's happening. You don't understand that really I am serving God here. But the slave girls that you're mocking, that you're saying I'm dancing with, They get it. They love me. They, like God, love me, not your father. And then we hear of Michal's fate. So to her dying day, Michal, daughter of Shaul, had no children. Now, this is a powerful statement here because it's not merely a personal summary of the story or a consequence of the estrangement between David and Shaul. In a sense, the storyteller tells us that the daughter of Shaul, and thus the house of Shaul, is done with. There's no continuity here. Michal, the last leading representative of this house, is barren. Perhaps we're also given a hint here that not only is this house barren, not only is Michal barren, but this way of leadership is barren. Shaul's brand of leadership couldn't lead to a fruitful continuation. It is David's brand of leadership that focuses on God, that is willing to demean himself under God, that draws the love of the people by dedicating himself to God for whatever motivation he has, which we're not always or not almost not never privy to. This is the brand of leadership that can last. We started the book of Shmuel with a contrast between a man sitting, Eli, and a woman standing up and walking, Chana. And we saw how the sitting, the passivity, the lack of initiative led to Eli's collapse, Eli's house's collapse, and Chana's initiative and willingness to take action and beg God for what she desires leads to continuity. In a sense, we're seeing here the flip mirror of that. We see a woman who doesn't have it within her what it takes, not due to herself, but to her house, the house she comes from, is doomed. And a man, David, who is willing not merely to walk and beg God for things, he's willing to dance and demean himself before God. And this is the brand of leadership that continuity can start with, that a dynasty can be established on. As we will see next week, this is far more complicated than that. And this moment, while being a moment of victory for David, a moment when finally the big contenders for the throne, the house of Shaul, are done with, is far from being the last moment of conflict. And when his house stands alone, it's going to start crumbling from within. And the problems are going to start within his own family and his own household. This is for us for next week. For today, let's finish on this high note in David's life, the moment where his brand of leadership succeeds and he moves forward, and allow ourselves to stay with that in mind for a week as we commemorate Tisha B'Av, as we remember the loss of the house that his son Shlomo built, but remember that the spirit of David is still amongst us. Thank you everybody for coming. I have a few minutes. I'm going to go over questions or comments. I can't reach all of them. Moment. Okay, so Arthur Stein is asking a question. You told us today that during Shaul's reign, after he conquered Amalek, the Philistines began trying to take possessions of the hill country. Is there any indication that they tried to do so during the time of the Shoftim, i.e. during the time of Eli? Was it their goal to take the hills? So the truth is that during the time of Eli, they had the hills. During the time of Eli, we are told that there was a governor, a Natsiv, a Philistine Natsiv in the mountain. In the land of Israel, you have the ocean, the hill country, and the mountain range. And the tribes of Israel were most settled in the mountain range. They had a great difficulty in the era of the judges settling in the flatlands where other people had technological superiority, because people like the Philistines or the Canaanites who lived in the plains had chariots. And the Israelite tribes had a great difficulty fighting against them. In the beginning of Judges, when we see that they don't conquer all the lands, most of the land they don't conquer are in the hill country or in the flatlands or in the valleys in the north. But I'm not going to go into that right now. Point being that in the time of Eli, the situation was so bad that the Philistines actually had strongholds in the mountain range itself. Shmuel started the process of pushing them down towards the hills. Shaul continued with David's aid, pushing them towards the flatlands by the ocean. On the eve of his death, Shaul lost the big battle up north in the valleys of the north with them. So as we see, it was an ongoing issue. After David, though, we no longer hear. After David's kingship, it seems that he won conclusively. There, we no longer hear about a Philistine threat, a real Philistine threat to the Israelites. Naomi Bar-Yam asks an excellent question. Is she barren of David? Is Michal barren or David not have relationship with her after this incident? Was this God's punishment or David's? I think that the text is leaving this ambiguous on purpose. We don't know if it's that she's barren because God chose to make her barren. We don't know if she's barren because she's not even barren, just David doesn't want to have anything to do with her. It could be he didn't want to have children with her regardless, so that his heir is not going to have Shaul's dynasty behind him as well, even before this particular estrangement. The important point is that the fact that the storyteller tells us at this point, I think, ties whatever it is that makes her incapable of having children with David to what we see in this clash between them. Both the animosity between them, but also the different ways of life they represent. Her way of life where the dignity of the king should stand no matter what, and his way of leadership where demeaning yourself under God is the right passage for the king to take. And his way wins. His way is the one that continues. iPad wrote, read David, see Malcolm Gladwell's book. Malcolm Gladwell in a book I think is called Underdogs or maybe it's even called David and Goliath. I don't remember. I read it also. He writes an excellent thing about David and Goliath. And he talks about, and as iPad points out, he talks about something similar, unconventional methods of doing things. This is an excellent recommendation. Arthur Stein points out that at the very beginning of Shaul's story, in the story of the missing donkeys, Shaul constantly fails to take initiative. Apparently, this is his fatal flaw, which reemerges at every stage of his career. Even in the story about the celebration ceremony after his victory over Amalek, he's pushed by both the people and his own sense of self-aggrandizement. Eventually, this drives him mad, whereas David thinks out of the box in order to confront and solve problems. A good summary of this very important contrast. Just a moment. Deborah Berkowitz has a very interesting suggestion as to why an interpretive, creative way of looking at why Ishai ignores David. She writes, perhaps David's father realized David's physical beauty and musical talents and did not want the brothers to get jealous, like in the Joseph story, or unlike in the Joseph story. And he sacrificed parental love and closeness to keep him safe. Likewise, perhaps he did not want his Davidole to be called to the kingship. I like this interpretation. This is new for me. This is very creative and beautiful. Thank you. I'm not sure I can totally square it with the text because something about the wording in the story is very cold. Is it purposeful coldness that's meant to protect David from jealousy and perhaps from the onerous tests of kingship? Maybe. It's a nice interpretation. I don't think we have a way to prove it one way or another, but I like that idea. It'll warm my heart to think about it next time I read the story. So thank you. Just a minute. Naomi Bar-Yam pointed out that while David may be very beloved, does not seem to extend to his children. And this is a very good point. We'll discuss it at length next week. A moment. iPad suggested, in the time of King David's grandsons and great-grandsons, etc., and even in the Northern Kingdom, the Book of Shmuel's purpose would not be to teach about David, but primarily to explain why there are two kingdoms and that usurping a king even while alive is allowed, especially Northern Kingdom. After all, King David did it, etc. To tell us how we got here to this point, but not to teach about David. So I would have to disagree with this, and I'm not alone in that. I mean, I understand that you're suggesting that my emphasis on David may be misplaced, that the book is more about how did we get to this point. It's more of a history book of where we are. True, and yet the book is crafted very, very carefully in many very, very careful ways, and by laying emphasis on particular things. And we can't just assume, okay, this is all just to explain the history and the story. We need to understand why it gives so much stage time to David specifically, and also why it presents David in these particular consistent ways throughout the story. By the way, Michael Walzer, in his book In God's Shadow, that talks about what it is to have power and politics under God in Jewish tradition, he argues, quite convincingly, I think, that in many ways, the book of Shmuel can almost be read as something that was written not just to tell us how we got to the point that we have two kingdoms, but to make an argument for why people should support the Judah kingdom and not Israel. Why this is the legitimate kingdom and Israel, the northern kingdom that will split off it later, is not. And a lot of the description of David on the one hand and Shaul on the other hand almost look like polemics trying to explain why he and his children should be the rightful kings and everybody who seceded from them is really going against God's will, which is another way to look at it. There's a lot more. We can discuss it at length, but I'm afraid that we have to finalize for now. Feel free to write to me and I'll try and get to it as soon as I can. Thank you, everybody. I have to sign off. My children need me.
Go. That's all right. Okay. You don't have to listen then. Thank you very much. We'll see you next week. Achron Chaviv. Okay. Thanks. Next week. Okay. Very good. Thank you. All right. Please, God, we'll see you tomorrow. Tomorrow we have a triple header. Marty Lakshin is back to finish off his series, two more classes on Pshat Rosh and Halakha. That's at 11 a.m. Eastern. Simi Peters at 1 p.m. on Sefer Yirmiyahu, and Moshe Sokolov on, of course, on the Haftar of the week. Thursday, we also have a triple header. Shuli Mishkin at 11 a.m., followed by Rabbi Jonathan Ziering on Shemitah as a lens into Torah understanding, and Rachel Slatsky's Parsha Shir at 8:30. She is the assistant director of program and comparative religion, I believe, at Harvard University. She'll be giving the Parsha Shir this week. And of course, my Pirkei Avot Shir Friday morning, 9:30 a.m. And Sunday, I actually put the link in the chat box a few moments ago. Eight speakers on the Tisha B'Av program beginning 11 a.m. Eastern time through to about 7:15 or so Sunday evening. So we can keep you occupied with hopefully appropriate and inspiring and maybe even comforting thoughts on Tisha B'Av. So that's on Sunday. You can sign up for the program, and we look forward to learning with you. And everybody be well, and invite your friends, let them know, and thank you very much. Have a wonderful day, everybody.